Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
Friday, August 8th, 2014, Episode 62, Dear Homeowner. Welcome, everyone, to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. My name is Kevin England, and I am truly happy to have everyone join us. This is a special edition of the podcast, a feature that is going to focus on a singular message. If you are a homeowner and you're here on referral, welcome. If you are a normal or first-time listener, let me take a moment to explain the context of this episode with a short introduction. In the brotherhood of beekeepers, there is, in my estimation, an unwritten code that we have an inherent responsibility to advocate on behalf of the bees. I don't know of any beekeeper that hasn't developed a love for the bees, and by proxy, a wonder of the environment that they and we live in. It's like a door to another world when one enters into the activity of keeping bees. Whether it's our internal lifelong focus to be a better beekeeper, a conversation with the neighbor next door, or if someday we become an official in a national beekeeping organization, we all share the responsibility of being able to deliver a proper message. To that notion, I have invested some time to produce this primer for anyone who is willing to take the time to learn and hopefully be enlightened on the topic of bees in our lives. My objective is to share a conversation for an intended audience of the homeowner, but anyone is welcome to listen in. And for the beekeepers taking in the podcast, my hopes are that you can use this to establish a baseline for how to find the voice to talk to others. So indulge me, if you will, to share what will be discussed in this episode, and then we'll jump right in. In today's episode, I'll follow a path of the following topics. In segment 1, we'll talk about why bees matter. Segment 2, while they are dear to our hearts, the truth is it's not just about the plight of the honeybees. All pollinators, and more so, the ecosystems around us need to be cared for. For the third segment, we'll ask, what about the bees? And talk about where the problem areas are. Segment 4, some ideas about how, as a homeowner, one can make an impact today. And we'll wrap up with some additional information in segment 5 about understanding stinging insects in the world we live in. And then we'll bring some closing comments to wrap things up. So segment 1, why bees matter. It starts with pollination, of course. Our talk has to start with plants and insects. Quite simply, plants produce pollen and nectar. Insects visit the plants for sugary sweet nectar and pollen, which is their protein and carbohydrates to live. By visiting numerous plants, they transfer pollen and pollinate the plants so that plants can reproduce. The visiting of each of the flowers is referred to as foraging. In the end, bees can't live without plants, and many plants cannot thrive without bees. So pollinators are vitally important. 85% of all the plants require pollination to produce seeds or fruit. One out of every 3 bites of food you eat is a result of pollinators. It goes without saying that flowers, fruits, and vegetables are highly dependent for reproduction, and more pollinators equates to larger yields and better plants. But it is not just about the bees. There are so many types and species of bees, but there are also flies, beetles, wasps, hummingbirds, bats. They're all pollinators, and even more. But make no mistake, honeybees do the heavy lifting, as they do about 80% of all the pollination duties. So examples of products that count on pollinators: almonds, watermelons, lemons, limes, apples, cantaloupes, squashes, cranberries, pumpkins, cotton, mango, avocado, peaches, broccoli, cauliflower, cucumbers, cabbage, papaya, sunflowers. They all require pollination by the honeybee, and that's just the short list. It can't be underestimated that pollinators play a role in improving the quality and yield of some of these items, but some of them, they're literally essential to them existing. For example, without pollinators, you have no squash, pumpkins, melons, watermelons, almonds, zucchini, macadamia nuts, and the list goes on. Think about pollination. One of the things, if this doesn't get you, cocoa. Yep, without pollination from something called a midge, a type of pollinator, chocolate would cease to exist. And that, in my book, is enough for everybody to understand how important pollinators are. So there's far more to the fundamental reason that pollinators are important. We can't forget the other side of the equation, which are products of the hive. Honey, of course, being the most notorious, but you have beeswax, propolis, and even venom. I mentioned a product in there called propolis. What is that? When a tree or a plant is broken or wounded, it exudes a liquid, and that liquid has healing properties for the plants. Now, bees are unique in the context that they can go out and pollinate just about any plant, but most plants have substances in them to keep insects from eating them down to the ground. But the bees have adapted to these plants for millions of years. So when a plant is wounded or it exudes some liquids, the bees collect that and bring it back, and it has antibacterial and antimicrobial functions in it, and they use it to coat their hive, and it's part of the inside of the colony system. Scientists and researchers are finding what a lot of people have known for a long time, that these products of the hive can be used for many different things, including potentially venom and propolis for serious unmet disease. At minimum, there's a long-standing use of honey to treat burns and for other antimicrobial, antibacterial reasons. So, and you can't forget that beeswax has been used for ages in industry and in the home for candles and lip balm and hand cream and other products. So products of the hive are equally as important in why we want to make sure we take care of our pollinator friends. For segment number two, we want to talk about, it's not just about the honeybees. There are so many types of bees, and there's many variants and contrasts. So honeybees get all the press, and as we said earlier, they get much of the credit for the heavy lifting, but the untold story is the incredible dependence we have on other native pollinators. Other pollinators and their importance cannot be underestimated. The makeup and diversity of native bees and where they live, how they nest, how they interact with the environment varies widely. This morning I was outside looking at some black-eyed Susan flowers in my yard, and there were no fewer than 10 different pollinators visiting to get the pollen and the morning dew. These pollinator bees and other insects are all around us working every day, and they mostly go unnoticed. Examples: solitary bees, wasps, bumblebees, stingless bees, carpenter bees, and many other variants are vital to the ecosystem of our plants and our communities and our gardens, and there are some 19,000 documented species of bees worldwide. As we said in the opening here, different species take on different responsibilities. The honeybee is not adept at pollinating a tomato or an eggplant flower, but some pollinators, native bees, are masters at this. Native bees come in a wide range of sizes. They also vary in their shapes, lifestyles, places they frequent, nests they build, flowers they visit, and season of activity. They remain unnoticed by most of us, yet they provide valuable services of all kinds to flowering plants, from wildflowers to some important crops. And it's suffice it to say, it is just as important to protect these pollinators as the honeybee. And the good news is, the conservation efforts for the honeybees, mostly, it's the same approach to apply to these native pollinators. A thing to keep in mind about these native pollinators is they are not domesticated. One of the main differences that the Americans came over from Europe in the 1800s and brought the honeybee with them. They're not native to the United States. And there was a time when many households had bees on their property because that's what they used to generate sweeteners. They used honey. Those days are gone. We go to the supermarket and we buy a bag of sugar. There are some native bees or insects that are kept by man, but they're generally for special purposes. So, for example, people will keep bumblebees inside of a greenhouse to pollinate certain kinds of products and flowers. But the fact of the matter is, while there's a lot of focus and a lot of attention on honeybees, we cannot forget that native bees, which are not kept by man, but are as equally important to society and the ecosystem and the world we live in. So segment number three, the title of this is Sure, But What About the Bees? Everybody's heard about the problem of the bees. And so what's going on? You know, the loss of honeybees is troublesome, not epidemic, but it is very disconcerting. The number of honeybee colonies in the United States has dropped 1.5 million hives, 37%. 37%. Can you imagine if we had 37% less cows in the U.S.? And that number, 37 or 1.5 million, is from 1970 to now. So to give perspective, there were 3.7 billion people in North America in 1970. Today there are 7.1 billion. Does this make any sense whatsoever? Historical rates of bee losses were 10 to 15%. Think about that ratio. One out of every 10 hives a year succumbed for some reason. Maybe the queen went bad, the colony absconded, don't know. But that's the norm. And beekeepers can overcome this. When 9 out of their 10 hives are in operation, they can pull one out, and they could use a procedure that beekeepers have where they pull some bees out, put them in a new box, it will generate a new colony. The donor colony has a setback. It's not operational for the year. And the new colony takes time to build and will not be viable for that season. But on the next season, it'll come online. If a beekeeper wants to get ahead, they'll pull a donor colony out and they'll make a couple colonies out of it. It's manageable. There's one thing that has to be entered into that equation, though, is time and effort. It takes time to pull a colony out, raise bees, feed them, provide equipment to house them in, and so on. So you have to factor that in, and 1 out of 10 was a workable model. Rewind the clock to 2006, and the average loss has been 30% year over year. Now, beekeepers can still recover, but think about the consequence of this. It takes time and money, as I just said, to reestablish lost colonies, and beekeepers rely upon their colonies to make revenue. If 1/3 of their bees are out of service and they're taking losses out of the production to pay for their recovery, how does that add up to a viable business model? The short answer is it doesn't. And more commercial beekeepers are stepping away from the business, and in time, there will be a threshold where pollination services will be a factor in the world economy. Actually, it's probably already there, but nobody's paying attention to it. So as an example, consider almonds. In California, the cost per hive to pollinate almonds, remember this is without bees, no almonds, was $50 for a season. The current rate is $175, maybe even $200. So in 2003, it cost an almond producer $50 to have a hive on the property for each one they needed. Now it's $200. Ever wonder why the cost of almonds is going up? And look at that pattern. Consider that the bees are pollinating what I said before. Blueberries and melons, sunflowers, peaches, apples, and a whole host of other products. The impact will show up in time. It has to. It's inevitable. So what's behind all of these losses? Fact of the matter is we don't know. Scientists, researchers, beekeepers were all trying to figure it out. The slogan given for the plight of the bees is called Colony Collapse Disorder, or CCD. The cause of this affliction is still up for debate. Bees see pressure from pesticides, predatory mites, beetles, and other organisms, loss of habitat, insecticides, farming practices, monoculture, viruses, and truth be told, even management practices and stress from beekeepers themselves. So some of this bears further explanation, and let's break a couple of them down. I'm going to go into a short highlight of some of the problems. And this is a highlight. There really could be an in-depth, separate episode on these things alone. But to illustrate the complexity of the problem, as not one thing that could be solved with a magic wave of the hand, here are some sound bites on some of the leading discussions on where researchers and the government and scientists are focusing their information and their attention. So I always say the first place to look is from within, and beekeeping practices are in question. There are poor beekeeping practices out there, both for commercial shortcuts, for inexperienced beekeepers, and people do things like take too much honey from the hive. That's not a good practice. There are things that are inside the ecosystem of the hive, mites. Varroa mite is public enemy number one in beekeeping. It's like a tick, if you've ever seen one, but bee-sized. It vectors viruses into the bees after it makes a wound. And what are we doing to solve this problem? We're trying to kill the mites inside, so we're putting insecticides in a box of insects. In the past, we used these products provided by the commercial industry called Cumafos and Fluvalinate. We don't use them anymore. They're ineffective against the mites, but they're making the bees sick. It's in the wax and in the products. And the other side of this is bees are meant to be in a tree, which has a cambium, which is the water jacket inside the tree that maintains the temperature, and the ecosystem and the bacteria and all of that, and we're keeping them in white boxes. So maybe the beekeeping practice itself, although it's been practiced for years, I don't know that we could start looking in that deep of a conspiracy theory. It is a little bit different from what nature intended. Now, one thing nature didn't intend is pesticides. And the U.S. is using a new class of pesticide systems that are probably better than the old ones, but highly detrimental to pollinators. The classification of products that has drawn the most attention are called neonicotinoids. They work by affecting the nervous system of the insect that comes into contact with it. And they're applied systemically to the plant. In other words, they are put on the seed, and when the seed grows, this neonicotinoid grows throughout the entire plant, and anything that eats or comes in contact with it, the target species, do not survive. So in a nutshell, the pesticide is getting to the bee through the plant, through inappropriate application by people who are using it, through distribution in the water table when the plant exudes liquids and it's getting into the ground, and this stuff has shelf life and the water carries it away and it goes down a stream and it gets pulled in by non-target species, in other words, plants along the waterbed, and it distributes that way. And really the problem comes not so much about whether these are appropriate to use, although that's being questioned, but much about how it was tested. They test these products on adult bees for a period of time in a certain kind of condition, and what they're not checking, as beekeepers are finding out and researchers are reporting, is the different effects in the way that the bees come into contact. If a bee goes out and visits a flower and a flower and a flower and it pulls a little bit of this back to its hive, and it does this every day, it's getting a little dose. The way that they test these things is they give them a big dose to see how much it kills them, and then they scale that back. Well, think about being sick in your home. This sublethal exposure every day is adding up to larvae, which were not tested. They had tested adult bees and things like that. So, you know, the bottom line is the neonicotinoids really need to be reviewed, and their use and other pesticides with it. The other side effect of this is they interact with other chemicals synergistically. One alone doesn't kill a bee. The other alone doesn't kill a bee. But you put two of these products out in a field, and they bring them back together, and they become a double potent weapon. So there's a lot of primordial soup going on here in the pesticide world that has not been viably tested, and it's starting to come more and more to the forefront that this is going to be a focus of attention to solve some of the problems for the bees. Now, that's not to villainize these companies that build these products. The government, the products, and the beekeepers all have to work together to come up with the right answers so that the farmers can keep producing food so we all eat. At minimum, and we'll talk about this later, the key thing is that they need to follow the labels. At minimum, they need to follow the labels. So we'll put that away for a minute, and now we'll come back to habitat loss. Simply, the reduction of forage in two ways. Literally, no more fields of flowers. And secondarily, monocrops. If you think about New Jersey, which is where this podcast originates, we have lost considerable habitat to building and population booms. And then people are putting in green lawns. And any dandelion that comes out gets eradicated. Any weed that grows along the edge of the border gets sprayed. We're lost habitat along the sides of the roads. They cut all the natural forage. Some of it is for safety concerns, but other times they just mow everything down. Farmers have been building their fields to get every ounce of yield that they can. And they're removing the borders where the bees used to forage. One different lens. Let's go another direction. Let's just talk simply about commercial management practices. 80%, I think, is the number of bees in the United States that get trucked out to California every year to pollinate the almonds. That is really a recipe for disaster. Take all the bees, put them on a truck, induce stress, stage the colonies in California, and then truck them back for wherever they come from. And they come from far and wide. Literally the East Coast, they come from Florida, they come from North Dakota, they come from Central Western Plains, things such as that. And they're out there working almonds, which is a vast monoculture, feeding on one food only while they're out there. And if there's anything going on from a standpoint of something bad that affects the bees, you have 80% of them all in one place, and then you truck them back to the United States everywhere. That is almost a recipe for disaster in that context. So, and it's a necessary evil. It's just the way that the industry has evolved over time. So it shouldn't be assumed that all commercial practices are irresponsible. That would not be fair whatsoever to the industry. But there's enough evidence about the stresses against bees in some of these practices that it warrants taking a long, hard look on how these things are done and working towards change in the way that commercial operations work. One such thing is feeding high fructose corn syrup or sugar solutions to the bees. Nature intended bees to live on diverse forage and nectar and honey. And fundamentally, corn syrup and sugar water solutions are not equivalent to the quality and nutrition of the honey that the bees made from nature. Isn't that common sense? So this topic depresses me. I don't like talking about it. So let me show the good news, right? Let's switch topics about this. There is something that can be done about this. And the bright side of the colony losses, because of colony collapse, the entire industry is under review. Practices are changing. Pesticides are being looked at scrupulously. Places like Home Depot and BJ's Wholesale just announced recently that they're going to either label or discontinue use of some of these neonicotinoids in the products that they sell to you and the homeowner. Research has increased, funding has increased, the understanding of the honeybee and the systems is being funded, which is vitally important to figuring out the problem. And more people are keeping bees. And awareness about the importance of the honeybee is in the general lexicon and pollinators. It's probably at an all-time high, which is a good thing. So far, we've talked about why bees matter, that while the honeybee is important, the conversation needs to be about all pollinators, a and we touched about some of the trouble spots, but what we haven't covered is how we, the mighty individual, can do something about this. In this segment, I'm going to provide suggestions that you, as an individual, can contribute to the resolution of the problem. I have 8 tips that you can do today to make a difference. The first one is simply let your grass grow a little higher. You know, there seems to be an abundance of clover this spring, and we should have let it grow. Set your mower a little higher, let it flower, and when it's done, cut your grass. They say it's generally better to have your grass higher anyway. It builds stronger root systems. Let your plants grow in the periphery of your yard. Build a little border or hedgerow or whatever. It's okay that way. Let it grow out front, next to the road, and so on. Apologize to your neighbor and bask in the glory of the dandelions in your yard. And when they switch over, mow the grass to distribute the seeds. Yes, I bet you didn't see that coming. On a more serious note, you could put some water out for the bees. This is the time of year, as I'm recording this, July-August time frame, when the water dries up here in New Jersey and the bees will struggle to find water nearby. The farther they have to fly, the harder they have to work, the more difficult it is for them. And they use water just like humans. They need to drink it. They use it to break down solids. They use it for honey and cooling the hive and other purposes, right? So they can't live without water. If you can provide a shallow container and put some rock or items in it so the bees can land and walk down, because bees don't like to get their feet wet. You could even consider a large bucket with some styrofoam peanuts floating in the water so they don't get saturated and sink. That's what we have out in our apiary. Just drill some holes in the side so if it rains, the bucket will fill up to a certain extent and the excess water will run out and they'll always have water in the bucket. Want to be more ambitious than that? Build a rock garden, but keep whatever water moving so you're not drawing mosquitoes. Providing water for the bees and the pollinators is a more proactive approach to them being where you don't want them, which means your pool or your dripping faucet, because that's the type of thing they want. When your faucet drips and it spatters on the ground, that's the right sip of water for a bee or a pollinator. And if you don't want them visiting your patio, you can do that. Incidentally, if you have them visiting something like a hummingbird feeder, change the ratio of sugar water and the bees won't be attracted, but the hummingbirds will keep coming. And simply, you could put out a bird bath and put rocks in it, and the birds will enjoy them and the bees will enjoy them, as we have that in several places on our property. Solution number 3 sounds complicated, but it's really not. Switch to natural pest remedies. So everything you apply is subject to being picked up and brought back to the hive. One thing that is a theory with bees is that pesticides in conjunction with herbicides are 1-2 punch for the bees, and studies are showing, as I mentioned earlier, that they're having this synergistic effect that is not evident on any label. Simply change the spray to soapy water instead of insecticides, and it'll do the job almost all cases, and it'll be less impactful. Another way to get around this is just simply pull the plant out. Put some water in the ground till it softens up and pull them out. It'll be easier to pull the plant roots if the water has saturated the ground. So you can make a simple homemade concoction today, and likely you have these ingredients in your house. Pour 5% vinegar into a spray bottle. For each pint of the vinegar, add 2 to 3 drops of dishwashing soap and 1 drop of vegetable oil. The reason you put the vegetable oil in there is it helps to coat the plant. Spray it on and the plant will not survive and nothing harmful is being applied in your yard. That's a double bingo. For number 4, and this is something everybody can do, switch to treating at night. And the whole premise of this is that the bees are out, they use the sun to navigate, the pollinators are out flying in your yard all day, but at night they go back to their nest. And if you do your treatments in the nighttime, or in the twilight, you should say, when the sun is not at full mast, you'll encounter less pollinators, and you'll do less damage. And by the way, it's cooler at night, so it's a better time to work. Simply switching to nighttime and avoiding the activity period where pollinators are foraging can make a big impact in your yard. If you care to be more proactive than that, just consider a pollinator garden. Go on the web, look up some bee-friendly plants, and make a trip to your local nursery. But check to see that they're not using pesticides inside, systemic pesticides, the neonicotinoids. One trip, and in 1 hour, in your yard, you could have plants ready to go for the bees. We recently had a community plant swap where we went and picked up a number of bees, bee balm and Monarda and things like that, that we have planted all around our yard. Now, maybe our bees aren't directly on them, but we do see pollinators visiting them all the time. If you have more property and you want to be more ambitious, replace a section of your lawn with a mix of wildflowers. Use native plants and you won't have to fuss over them. Examples for us in our area and something that the bees really love: New England aster, mountain mint, lupin, bee balm, cardinal flower, goldenrod, milkweeds. You'll get butterflies also. So all of those are perennials, and of course milkweed is the haven for monarch butterflies. And other options you can, if you're really ambitious, sunflower, zinnia, spearmint, lavender, catnip, marigold, yarrow, black-eyed Susans, as I mentioned earlier. You could even plant an herb garden. Basil, mint, oregano, rosemary, thyme, they're all easy to grow and they are attractive to many pollinators. The one thing to keep in mind is pollinator season runs from spring to fall. And there are times when pollinators don't have good forage to work with. So consider a swath of plants that go from one season to another and provide pollination capability in your yard all year long. They will really appreciate it. So you might say, well, how do I know about that? I'll give you a resource. If you're from New Jersey, the New Jersey Beekeepers Association has a place that explains blooming times, a list of plants that are native to New Jersey and the time of the year that they bloom. It's njbeekeepers.org/pollenplants.htm. But it really is pretty simple to go search on the internet for any place where you are and find this information out. It is available to you. If anything, you could look for a local extension center, agricultural resource in your community. They will be glad to do this. Another place to look is a Xerces Society. That's spelled with an X, C, Xerces. So for idea number 6, think about backyard projects for native bees. If you're not the type of person that wants to put honeybee hives in your backyard, you can build some simple nests for native pollinators. You could take a 4x4 section, little piece, maybe 8 inches long, drill a bunch of holes in it, tack it up to something, and the mason bees will come in and do something. They'll make a nest out of it. You can go on the internet and look for nests of native bees, and there's a bunch of different short projects that you could do with your kids, get them involved in this situation, or you can go out in the garage one afternoon and build yourself some nests to put up around. And incidentally, that includes bat hives, as bats do pollinate at times. So two more to go. Idea number 7. This one's the easiest one for everybody to follow. Support your local farmers. We cannot underestimate the value of farmland. Buy your products local. Encourage your grocery store to buy local. Go to your local farm stands and support roadside sales of produce in your neighborhoods. And of course, buy local honey. That's a no-brainer. Educate the youth and set the example by buying local. And then last but not least, and this is, frankly, the number one reason. I left it to last, but I wanted to have a lasting impact. Number 8 is make a promise to read the label and follow the instructions. That starts when you're in the store before you put it in your cart. Read the label. Know what you're buying. If you're going to buy something, make sure you understand the impact of it before you bring it home and start spraying it in and around your property. Look for indications of harmful impacts to pollinators. There are new bee labels available on some of these things. Read it every time you use it without fail and follow the instructions. The worst thing that happens, and quite frankly, homeowners that are worse than farmers a lot of times. If one spray is good, two is better. No, that's really not good at all. You can really poison the landscape in and out around your home, so don't do that. Be judicious about the products that you buy and then use them sparingly and follow the labels. The most important piece to follow. So that's 8 ideas, but there are so many more. And if you're interested, you can again go out to the internet and look for ways to help pollinators. There's lists out there. I've just touched the surface here, but that's a good start, and it's something that you should do today. So do take action. So one more segment to go, and this is about living with bees. I would love to end with what we just talked about, but quite frankly, I don't think any homeowner conversation is complete without talking about bees in and amongst where we live. I want you to remember a phrase, and it's busy as a bee. This is really important to explain to your children or for you to understand when you're living in your garden or walking around in your yard or visiting some place where you see bees throughout your environment. They're not interested in you. And I always say, nothing to see here, move along, citizens. Honeybees in particular will not sting away from the hive unless you do something to alarm them. Swat them, step on them, surprise them in some way. They have a job to do, which is to forage and bring back nectar, pollen, water, whatever they're doing for their resource seek. They're not interested in you. And for the most part, they will avoid you. They are aware of who you are. They do know what humans are. But they don't go out of their way to attack. For the most part, though, wasps, hornets, carpenter bees, and others will also avoid you in the open. But interfere with their nests, and that's a different story. Wasps, yellow jackets in particular, can be very aggressive. So the first thing to do is to know about identification. How can you tell what it is? So let's talk about honeybees in comparison to other stinging insects, and it's pretty simple to identify them. Honeybees and yellow jackets are probably the most common-looking insects. A honeybee has a barrel body. It's very stout, from head to tail. In comparison, other stinging insects usually have a narrow waist. Honeybees are fuzzy and more muted in comparison to yellow jackets, which they are mostly confused with, as I said. Yellow jackets are bright yellow and black. They have jagged bands of alternating yellow and black markings and distinctive yellow legs. Honeybees are often a warm golden yellow with shades of tan and brown stripes towards the back of the bee. So again, honeybees, linebacker, wasps and hornets, pinched waist, slender wasp. And most wasps and hornets are a little bit bigger than the common honeybee. And some of them, such as something commonly referred to as the cicada killer, can be almost 2 inches long. You can't forget about bumblebees and carpenter bees. These are things that you often come across, especially if you live in wooded areas. These things are like dump trucks. No reason to confuse them with a honeybee. They are thick through the middle and very loud when they fly because their wings have to carry so much weight in comparison. So bumblebees are covered with fine hairs. Carpenter bees do not have hair on the back part of the bee, the abdomen, and they're often shiny black, almost like iridescent in color. Both carpenter and bumblebees can sting, but here's a little trick. Male carpenter bees are very territorial. They'll look you right in the eye and they'll do flybys, but it's all show because they have no stinger. How about that? You can tell that it's a male because they have a yellow marking on their forehead. and they will literally fly to your nose and your eyes and zoom around in front of you, and they're all show and no go. So inevitably at some point you will have encounter with bees, and sometimes they do need to be managed. If you see a honeybee swarm, a large cluster of bees hanging from something, call a beekeeper. Do not spray them. It's illegal to kill bees. At least in New Jersey it is. It should be illegal everywhere as far as we're concerned. This is the time of year where you run into yellow jackets. A lot of times it might be nested in the ground. You go over them with your lawnmower, you stir them up, and they come out and they get you. That is never a fun occurrence, and I know that my dog found a yellow jacket nest just last week and got stung a number of times. So if these nests are in the ground, pesticides are not going to be ineffective, and basically you're poisoning your ground, so don't do that. One of the things you can do is go out on a cool night and set up a hose over the hole and use a vacuum cleaner. In the morning, come out and turn it on and leave it there for a few hours, and you'll get all of the bees exiting. One thing I've seen people do, and I don't recommend this, is to put water in the hole. A lot of people will encounter also paper wasps. They hang from a little comb, like a little tiny spot where they connect. This small connection point is amazing that it carries that whole comb. You want to spray these from a distance, and you do spray these with wasp killer. Only a small amount is needed, but make no mistake, they'll vigorously defend, so stay away. Another common occurrence is bald-faced hornets. These are usually in a grocery sack-sized paper nest that almost looks like paper mache. They build on eaves, they build hanging off of trees, they're usually up in high places. And if they are high, that's all the better, because they won't bother you. And the good news is, come the cold, first frost, they will die off, the queen will leave the hive, she'll go bury into the ground, and you can remove that nest with no muss, no fuss, nobody's going to sting you. They don't occupy the hive in cold weather. But if you have to remove them, they're in a place where you walk by and they come out every time you go through. Go out at night, wear a beekeeping suit, put them in a plastic bag, pull them down, and take them out somewhere and put them on the ground, and the bees will disperse, or the hornets will disperse. What we've heard about this, and I've never done this, so I'll be first to admit, is that you find the holes where they're entering and you duct tape them, and then you put them in a plastic bag and you take them away. Would recommend that you have a beekeeper help you or somebody in a beekeeping suit. You don't want to do this in plain clothes. Unfortunately, if it's not an option, you may have to resort to spraying them down with wasp spray. And even in that case, you're probably going to want to wear a bee suit. Another thing that you might come across is a thing called a mud dauber. Most common is a pipe organ mud dauber. I have these hanging off my garage right now. They've been there all summer, and they come and they go, and we've never bothered them. They're a skinny-waisted, solitary, bluish-black bee. They're actually probably a wasp. And they build pipe-shaped mud nests in protected areas such as walls, under eaves, and attics. I have one built in a PVC pipe that I have sitting up inside the rafters of my garage. And what's funny is they go in and out, and you can hear them buzzing in there, and the tube makes it sound like there's a million of them up there. They really rarely sting people, and in the winter you can wash off the mud. They won't be in there again. They go away. If at the end of the day you have a beekeeping problem, honeybees, call a beekeeper. Someone will come and take care of it. Now, that being said, there are times when bees get into places where it's difficult to get them out. They go into a wall, they go into an attic roof, they get into a barn. You really want to hire a professional to do that. And unfortunately, but it is necessary, sometimes you have to pay them because it's a considerable effort. They'll spend a day, 2 days, whatever, of time and money and their energy to do this. Some beekeepers will do it for free, but make sure you get somebody who has knowledge and experience in this, lest you have a bad experience with a beekeeper. At the end of the day, other types that we mentioned, and we went through some ideas, If you're not equipped to handle it, call a pesticide company or an exterminator, I mean, and they will come and take care of it. And they also know that it's illegal to kill bees, so they won't do that. If in doubt, almost every beekeeper's association that I know of has a swarm page where you can call and ask questions, and almost all beekeepers are prepared to give you some sort of a guidance like this. And in essence, there's beekeepers all over, and maybe one of them can come to you if need be and give you some advice. One thing you will hear from people who trap swarms or capture swarms is they generally don't want to come out for wasps and other problems. They're going to ask you to take a photo, and they're going to ask you to provide some guidance about where exactly the honeybee swarm is before they come and collect it. But if they're not going to do that, they may be able to give you some guidance on who you could seek to get alternate means for getting rid of your problem. I'm not advocating call beekeepers for this. Sometimes the best answer is to call an exterminator, but they will be helpful in almost all cases. So we've come to the end of the episode, and I hope the information presented has been useful. The typical audience for this podcast are beekeepers, hobbyists primarily, but sometimes people from other nations or commercial people. For most of you, you probably know much of this, and hopefully this is a way for you to learn the message and pass it on if you hadn't, and more importantly, you could share it with your family, your friends, your neighbors, your co-workers, and people in your community. If you ever find yourself in the position to speak an event or have a conversation where people are left wanting to know more about beekeepers and beekeeping and what they can do to contribute, feel free to share this episode. That's what it was for, and we hope, again, that you found it useful. If by chance you are not a beekeeper, but a homeowner, and you've made your way here on the aforementioned notion of sharing this, thank you. Thank you for taking the time and caring to check in with us. It goes without saying that honeybees are remarkable insects. One can only be amazed to learn that as individuals they operate together to form a superorganism that achieves wonders that even scientists to this day still can't explain. Please know that as beekeepers and citizens, we appreciate your concern and attention to the subject, and like the bees in a colony, every one of us can add up to an amazing achievement and make a difference. That's it for this episode. If you have questions or comments, please send me an email to kevin@bkcorner.org. You can follow us on facebook.com/beekeeperscorner, and if interested, see Beekeeping in Action at our YouTube channel, youtube.com/nwnjba. Our website is www.bkcorner.org. Thank you for stopping by the Beekeeper's Corner, and until next time, be well, everybody.